This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. This past Sunday, Turkey held elections, and the people of Turkey awarded their president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, broad new executive powers. People are saying that this is really like a new dictatorship. We're going to hear a report from Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal on what this means for Turkey. And South Africa is on the verge of what looks like civil war, thanks to politicians stirring people up over land ownership. We're going to hear a report about this from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller. Also, on a recent trip I took, I was with one of our Herbert W. Armstrong College students, Tony Seme, who's from Tanzania. We had a fascinating conversation about life in his home country, and his perspective really made me appreciate some of the things about America that I think a lot of us can easily take for granted. I brought him into the studio to share some of his insights. At the end of the show, I want to talk about something dangerous you're probably carrying around in your life that I want to encourage you to get rid of. We'll start, though, learning about the dramatic elections in Turkey, thanks to this report by Brent Noctegal.
Turkish strongman Recep Tayyip Erdogan has likely cemented his control over the nation for the next decade by cruising to victory in Sunday's parliamentary and presidential elections. The victory culminates a 15-year transformation of Turkish politics, overseen and largely orchestrated by Erdogan himself. Now, new executive powers will be transferred to Erdogan as a result of a 2017 change in the constitution that was pushed by Erdogan that made Turkey an executive presidency. Erdogan will be able to rule till 2029. "I have been entrusted by the nation with the tasks and duties of the president," Erdogan said as he claimed victory. According to the chief of Turkey's election authority, Erdogan defeated his closest rival with an absolute majority. He won 52.5% of the vote in the presidential poll. In the parliamentary elections, Erdogan's Justice and Development Party and its coalition partner easily won more than half of the seats. This tandem of parliamentary control combined with the new presidential powers, which include executive power over the judiciary, gives Erdogan unchecked and unmatched power in the modern era of Turkey. However, while many past elections in Turkey witnessed a high level of irregularities, this one seemed to be largely undoctored. Indeed, with 88% turnout in Sunday's election, Erdogan says that, quote, "Turkey has given a lesson in democracy to the entire world," end quote. How is it, then, that the democratic nation of Turkey, with some 80 million people, has wittingly handed dictatorial powers over to Erdogan, confirming him as the first sultan of the modern Turkish era? And what does this say, not just about Erdogan, but rather about the condition of the modern nation of Turkey? First, let's look how we got here. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. It is necessary to remember that although Turkey is over 95% Muslim, the modern state was created in such a way to ensure a separation between the state and religion. That secularism was a result of the rule of the modern Turkish founder Mustafa Atatürk. Out of the ashes of the Ottoman Empire, Atatürk enacted such laws as banning religious clothing such as the hijab. He put mosques under the state control and even removed Islam from the constitution as the state religion. Since Atatürk's rule ended, there have been numerous attempts to water down Turkey's secular foundation. However, most of those were put down through the timely intervention of the military, which is seen as the vanguard for keeping Turkey secular. Recep Tayyip Erdogan's first major position came in 1994 when he was made mayor of Istanbul. While at that post, Erdogan's Islamist leanings were clearly visible, going so far as to call himself the Imam of Istanbul. While he did bring a certain amount of prosperity and change to the city, Erdogan started to push back at Atatürk's vision for the state, all the while stating that he was giving the people what they wanted. In 1997, he made his desires a little too overt as he decided to read a religious poem at a rally. This led to his arrest and imprisonment for 4 months. However, after coming out of prison, his popularity only seemed to increase. In 2002, he joined national politics and eventually became prime minister in 2003, leading Turkey throughout the next decade and slowly began blurring the lines between religion and the state. In 2014, he became president of Turkey. He quickly changed the largely ceremonial role of the president and ended up dominating several Turkish prime ministers. It all seemed to be going well for Erdogan. However, all those gains were put in jeopardy on the night of July 15, 2016. That was the evening that Turkish tanks rolled into Istanbul. Soon, the sonic boom of tactical jets and the low thumping of helicopters could be heard flying overhead. A coup d'etat was underway as the military tried to remove Erdogan from power. For a moment, it looked like time might finally be up for President Erdogan's regime. Within hours, though, the effort collapsed. Forces loyal to the president violently repelled the anti-regime soldiers. In the conflict, more than 2,100 people were injured and more than 300 were killed. The military had protected Turkish secularism for more than 50 years. In 1960, 1971, 1980, and 1997, the military had preserved the modern secular democratic state by successfully overthrowing the government. But not this time. Erdogan managed to evade the revolutionaries as they descended on the coastal hotel where he had been staying. He then appeared on CNN Turk, calling on his supporters to take to the streets and use all means necessary to stop the insurrection. The people obeyed, defying the military's imposed curfew. Footage quickly emerged on social media of men in plain clothes trying to hold back battle tanks, some even lying in front of them as they plowed forward. This further motivated Erdogan's supporters to come out in droves. The iconic moment of the coup came the next day. It wasn't the image the military had hoped for, Erdogan in handcuffs. Instead, it was the image of soldiers laying down their weapons in surrender and being marched off the Bosporus Bridge. The military takeover had failed. Worse, though, than just botching the coup, the futile military action gave the president the rationale he needed to remove dissenters from positions of power throughout the nation. And since that time, the Turkish government has shut down 189 media outlets, arrested over 300 journalists, closed more than 3,000 schools, dormitories, and universities, dismissed 4,463 judges and prosecutors, fired 5,822 academics and some 146,000 state officials. Erdogan's men have arrested 77,000 people and detained 136,000 other people. All of these people are accused of having connections to Gulen, an enemy of Erdogan who now lives in exile in Pennsylvania, and who Erdogan blames for the coup attempt in 2016. Thus, Erdogan has gained absolute control over the judiciary and the military, and virtual control over the academia and the press in Turkey. And with all of his opposition out of the way, Erdogan felt strong enough to start changing the Turkish constitution. In a nationwide referendum on April 16, 2017, Turks narrowly voted to pass 18 constitutional amendments that have transformed the nation from a parliamentary democracy into a presidential republic, effectively an executive presidency. And the first election under this new system took place on Sunday. While there was a healthy opposition to Erdogan, it still wasn't enough to dethrone him. Erdogan now has the opportunity to rule for more than the next decade as president, with powers more akin to President Putin of Russia than that of any democracy. Nevertheless, it is an important and often overlooked fact to remember that the people chose him. While not all elections are free and fair in Turkey, and indeed controlling the national press on the lead-up to an election can certainly tilt the scales, the fact remains that a majority of Turks want Erdogan as their leader. This transformation in Turkey is not a rare fluke. As Trumpet magazine editor Joel Hilliker recently wrote, it is part of a trend that is affecting other major nations. For nearly two centuries, democratic free societies led by the British Empire and the United States have flourished, but modern sophisticated, wealthy, and well-armed nations such as Turkey are now reverting to authoritarianism. In Asia, Vladimir Putin is dominating Russia. Xi Jinping is dominating China. Shinzo Abe is reviving militarism and nationalism in Japan, and Rodrigo Duterte is bluntly, unapologetically, and vulgarly scorning the rule of law in the Philippines. In Europe, record numbers of voters are electing nationalists. Viktor Orban in Hungary, Sebastian Kurz in Austria, Andrej Babis in the Czech Republic. In the Middle East, the flash of optimism during the Arab Spring is over, and the region has emerged even less democratic and free, ruled by autocrats, driven by tribalism and violent turf wars. By several measures, looked at globally, the power of governments and individual leaders is growing, and the freedoms of the people are eroding. People are recognizing that the world is getting more aggressive and more dangerous. People are looking for security and protection, and strong men are promising to provide it. In Turkey, that man is Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and he now has more power than any Turkish leader has since the fall of the Ottoman Empire.
Well, thank you for that, Brent. So there's obviously a lot of people within Turkey who are really unhappy with what's happening here, but in the end, even though Erdogan obviously controls a lot of the levers of power, controls the media and so on, as you mentioned in your report, there doesn't seem to be evidence that there was great tampering or that he rigged this specifically in terms of the vote count. So is it your sense that there really are a majority of Turks who say, yes, this is what we want?
Yeah, definitely. So I feel like Erdogan has been able to capture the mood of the people for a long time. Of course, he does have his means of trying to create the mood or direct the public to where he wants to go through the use of media. But also, even looking back through, if it's his mayoral candidacy for Istanbul or going to be the prime minister races or the races for the AKP, for his party within the parliament before the legislation, before the constitutional amendments, he has done very well with the public. He is extremely charismatic. He is able to speak to the regular guy. He's known for having an open communication with members of the public. Of course, it's half the public or a bit under half that he silences. I'm not trying to belittle that fact, but he has done well at using his personality and ensuring that the national discussion is in his favor, is things that he can make sure that he can provide for the people. And so this is the will of the people. He said as much. 88% of Turks voted. I mean, any modern democracy in Europe, the United States, would love 88% of the population to vote where it's not compulsory. And so he had that. And he reached over 50% of the public voting for him personally in the presidential race. So there was a parliamentary election as well, and his party did well, and his party along with the coalition party, they're going to form the majority inside the parliament. But as far as voting for actual presidential candidates, he outstripped the nearest person by 20%. 20% of 88 million people, I'm not going to do the math, but that's millions and millions of people in favor of Erdogan ruling them with the full knowledge that he is going to be ruling them with these new presidential powers. It is something that the majority of Turkish people want.
So do you see this? What do you see as his goal in, revising the powers of the presidency? What are his larger goals?
Well, obviously, he wants to preserve his own rule.
Is it just about his personal power, or what are his goals for Turkey?
Well, it's not about his just personal power. Sure, he is a dynamic figure that believes a lot in himself. He said that this was a victory for the world, basically, in one of his victory speech, him being elected. But he also, not just personal aggrandizement or preserving rule, he also believes that he is the one to guide Turkey through uncertain times. And he talked about himself in that fashion in his some of his speeches leading up to this, Turkey sees itself right now as vulnerable. The public see themselves as vulnerable. They look around the world and they see chaos and disorder and even different parts of their own country in that sort of state. And then you've got the Syrian war going crazy, and they want a leader that is going to protect them. And he has promised that. He's riding the wave of nationalist sentiment that exists in Turkey as it exists elsewhere. And he believes he's the man for the job.
So looking at this, how does what is happening in Turkey affect its relationships with its neighbors? How does it affect its relationships with the nations within the region, or what's happening just in the Middle East and in those environments, and then more broadly with the United States and particularly with Europe and its NATO allies?
Right. So Turkey is a part of NATO. They're meant to be shoring up the southern border of Europe, and yet we have seen Turkey kind of playing the game with Russia, playing the game with Iran in some instances, showing that they are not attached to Europe as much as they have seemed to want to. Even Erdogan seemed to want to in the early 2000s. That's what he campaigned on in the early 2000s as prime minister, is that, hey, they're going to let us into, or at least go through that process of making us part of the European Union. And people loved that at the time. Now it looks like Europe needs Turkey just as much as Turkey would like to have Europe,
right.
Europe's friendship. And so he's playing that up. Turkey is in a vulnerable situation just because it doesn't have really many national resources. And so economically it needs trade with other nations. And so it's always going to be connected to others. But it also acts as the gatekeeper for Middle Eastern refugees going up into Europe. So it is valuable for Europe to have a friend in Turkey. So either whoever rules Turkey is going to have to be worked with if you're Europe. It doesn't matter if it's Erdogan, doesn't matter if it's somebody else, doesn't matter if he cracks down civil liberties. If you care about Europe itself more than just the maintaining the moral European desired morals of who you're going to work with as far as human rights go, you're going to have to work with him. And even though he has taken dictatorial powers, it looks like he has those now, even though the people voted for that. I mean, in this day and age, you would want, given the situation of the world and the chaos in the Middle East, you would want somebody that is able to deliver on their promises. Democracy is good and well, but when it hamstrings a process of protection for Europe or working a deal with Turkey, you want somebody that you can work with. And Erdogan is a one-man rule. Maintaining that is somebody you can work with.
Well, that is an extraordinary statement that you just made. The idea that what we're seeing in Turkey really is a measure of just how much the world is changing and how much the population of this major NATO nation and a major power within the Middle East and within the world is taking such a strong, hard turn in this direction is really quite extraordinary. Just very briefly, Brent, viewing this in light of Bible prophecy, can you just contextualize this and maybe direct our listeners to further resources that would help them to put it in context?
Sure. We can definitely, looking at the Bible prophecies of this end time, we see spoken about this on this program before, the fact that we have all the way around the world in Bible prophecy, and now we're coming onto the scene, strong leaders. We have kings, princes mentioned in prophecy, many, many kings in the end time. And looking at the democracies and the nations 50 years ago, it'd be hard to pin down a king because you had prime ministers in and out. Now we're getting the situation through nations in Europe, Russia, China, Japan, where you have dominant personalities that are ruling over those nations. And that fits into Bible prophecy perfectly. Our whole, I think it was the January trumpet issue, was about this past year. Just the specific article that people can read about that trend is A New Strongman Age, an article they can read from January 2018, The New Strongman Age.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about elections in Turkey this past Sunday. Go to thetrumpet.com and read his article, Erdogan Victorious in Snap Elections, Claims New Autocratic Powers. Thanks for your time, Brent.
No problem.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
South Africa is on the verge of what looks like civil war, and emotions are riding high. There's even talk of a violent revolution over land ownership. We'll learn about this in this report from Andrew Miller.
Farmers face a choice between genocide or Zimbabwe-style land grabs. Land ownership is an explosive issue in South Africa. When the nation ended institutionalized racial segregation in 1994, white farmers owned 85% of the nation's privately held farmland. Over the next 24 years, the government purchased and redistributed more than 5 million acres of farmland. Meanwhile, black citizens purchased more than 12 million acres on the open market. Yet last year, the government estimated that white South Africans still own 72% of the nation's farmland. The African National Congress promised in 1994 to transfer 30% of white-owned land to blacks by the year 2000. This has not happened, and many feel the process of land redistribution is moving too slowly. To speed things up, South Africa's president has pledged to abandon the government's willing buyer, willing seller principle in favor of a new policy. The government wants to start confiscating white-owned land without monetary compensation. A constitutional review committee is still examining the legality of such land seizures and expects to have a decision by the end of August. In the meantime, however, Julius Malema, who leads South Africa's third largest political party, is saying that if white people do not surrender their land, there will be a violent revolution in the country. In a June 11th interview with TRT World, the leader of the Economic Freedom Fighter Party told the interviewer that he was not calling for the killing of white people yet.
I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I'm saying to you, we've not called for the killing of white people, at least for now. I can't guarantee the future.
Yeah, but I mean, you'd understand somebody watching that, especially as it gets shared on Twitter, they freak out. It sounds like a genocidal call.
Cry babies. Cry babies.
I'm not calling for the slaughter of white people, at least for now.
I can't give you a guarantee of the future, especially when things are going the way they are.
Subtext.
Especially if things are going the way they are, there will be a revolution in this country, I can tell you now. There will be an alert revolution. An alert revolution is the highest form of anarchy.
Speaking to an ENCA interviewer 3 days later, Malema clarified his remarks, saying he believes South Africa's poor will rise up against landowners, whether or not he has anything to do with it.
You see, civil war which will happen in this country, it will not be as a result of Malema saying one or two things. It will be out of the frustration our people are confronted with. There is a serious problem of underdevelopment, there's a serious problem of not sharing the resources of this country, and the whites becoming more richer and the blacks becoming more poor. We ought to confront it, we ought to be honest about it. We must not be scared, and generations after us will thank us.
The World Bank estimates that South Africa is the most unequal nation in the world in terms of income. Yet Malema is incorrect in asserting that whites are becoming richer while blacks are becoming poorer. Over the past three decades, racial disparities in living standards have narrowed in South Africa. According to The Economist, whites made up 86% of those in the top standard of living bracket in 2004. They make up less than 50% in this bracket today. So total inequality remains wide while racial inequality is narrowing. This is because many members of South Africa's new economic elite are black men like Malema, whose net worth is around $2 million. Malema misconstrues facts in a bid to get the over 2 million South Africans who voted for him in 2016 to support Zimbabwe-style land grabs. Despite his claim that civil war is coming with or without him, Malema has played a major role in exacerbating racial tensions in South Africa. In 2011, he was tried by South Africa's Equity Court for singing a song that called for the shooting of white farmers with machine guns. 5 years later, he was tried again for encouraging his supporters to illegally occupy white-owned land. A March 2017 AFRIFORM study noted that farm murders jumped 92% the month after Malema's 2011 call for illegal land occupation. So even if South Africa's government does not begin confiscating white-owned land like Zimbabwe began doing in 2000, the inflammatory rhetoric used by politicians like Malema is already moving people to violence. According to a paper published by researchers from South Africa's Agricultural Business Chamber, there is a real threat that a lack of clarity on what politicians mean when they say things like "take the land back" could prompt citizens to disregard the rule of law and take matters into their own hands. Under this scenario, farm murders and illegal land occupations would escalate, leading to an enormous loss of life and a non-functioning agricultural sector. It is a tragic fact that more than 3,000 white farmers have been murdered since the end of apartheid in 1994. And this rising violence is reminiscent of a sobering prophecy from the Bible. In Ezekiel chapter 7, verses 23 and 24, it says, "Make a chain, for the land is full of bloody crimes, and the city is full of violence. Wherefore I will bring the worst of the heathen, and they shall possess their houses." Now this passage says that so many bloody crimes occur in the end time that it will be like links in a chain, one following right after the other. It also describes the seizure of people's homes and violent conflicts between those of Israelite and those of non-Israelite descent. In his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, Herbert W. Armstrong explained how British and Dutch South Africans are actually descended from the ancient Israelites. So this prophecy in Ezekiel describes a time of trouble and tribulation that will soon affect all the descendants of Israel, including those in South Africa. This happens because of the sins or the abominations of the people. The Bible says God is allowing this chain of violence so that the people of end-time Israel will be forewarned of what is coming unless they cry out in repentance.
Thank you, Andrew. So the way that things seem to be tracking with this new policy of South Africa's president, a lot of people are looking at this and saying, essentially, South Africa is going the same way that Zimbabwe did, that there was a similar policy enacted there. What's your view of that?
Well, they're definitely calling for the same type of actions they took in Zimbabwe. And just to recap, in about the year 2000, Robert Mugabe's dictatorship basically just stepped in and made a decision that the government's taking all white-owned land without compensation, which they did. There was about 24 people who died in the process, who were killed in the process over conflicts over the land. And it just absolutely devastated Zimbabwe's economy. Now, that's exactly the type of thing Malema's calling for in South Africa.
And it devastated the economy because you're eliminating the farmers who know how to farm, and you're replacing them with people who don't know how to farm and gutting the agricultural sector. Is that right?
Right. That's you have people who've been farming for decades who know all how all this works, and then all of a sudden you just like snap the fingers and one day they're all dispossessed from their land. You bring in a bunch of other people who haven't done that before.
Yeah.
That's initially why South Africa instituted their willing buyer, willing seller program, as it is a much slower, more gradual process. But by the time a black citizen who hasn't farmed before comes into possession of a farm, generally only those who've learned the skill set to manage it are able to do that.
Yeah. So the contrast with South Africa then?
Yeah, because in South Africa, I mean, they're calling for that, but they haven't done it yet, which kind of puts them in like a limbo state where you still have all the like the virulent hate speech and rhetoric talking about how we need to take this land and all our problems are the results of this white minority, but they don't actually follow through with it. So you get the resentment and the population build up so much that they oftentimes take matters into their own hand and just kill a white farmer, go vigilante on the system. And that's why you're looking at 224 people murdered when Zimbabwe took the land. South Africa hasn't taken the land, but you have up to 3,000 people murdered. So just multiple times worse than Zimbabwe in terms of the violence.
Now, Malema actually said it's because of the policy being enacted without implementation that the resentment is rising up even more. And he's basically saying this revolution is going to happen whether I'm here or not. It's not necessarily like he's saying we need to revolt. He's saying this is going to happen.
Right. In some ways, he is kind of giving an ultimatum. He's like, do what Zimbabwe did and have the government step in and take the land, or there's going to be a violent revolution where we just start killing the whites and take it ourselves. And now he's saying that this is going to happen with or without him. Maybe he's right about that, but the type of rhetoric he's used about, like, whites conducting a genocide against the blacks and misconstruing some of South Africa's history, as he's definitely made those racial tensions even worse than they were to start with.
Yeah. So looking at South Africa, you kind of get a sense of just how brutal race relations can get. How much do you view what's happening in South Africa as something of a morality tale or a warning as to how these types of problems may spread elsewhere?
Right. Well, we mentioned a prophecy towards the beginning of the segment about those of Israelite descent because of their sins and the mismanagement and factors like that coming into violent conflict with those of non-Israelite descent. And that's a prophecy that applies to all the nations of Israel, Britain, the United States, and South Africa included. I know the late trumpet writer Ron Fraser always used to say that South Africa and oftentimes kind of ended up being like a preview of what's coming to these other Israelite nations. It was the most advanced towards that stage, to where they're on the stage of civil war now, where the United States and Britain aren't maybe not quite as far along that path, but there are still similar sins, similar problems that are going to lead to a similar outcome.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about trouble in South Africa regarding land ownership. He has an article at thetrumpet.com titled South Africa on the Verge of Civil War. Go check it out. Thanks for your time, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
A little ways north of South Africa, on the east coast of Africa, is the nation of Tanzania. And here at our offices in Edmond, Oklahoma, on the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College, we have a student from Tanzania. He's just completed his sophomore year. His name is Lastin Seme, but everyone calls him Tony. Tony was my companion on a recent trip. We found ourselves in an airport with a three-hour layover. We went and got some breakfast, sat down at a table, and I started asking him questions about life in his home country. And suddenly, 3 hours had gone by in a flash. We had to move. It was a fascinating conversation, and I wanted to share some of it with you today. So I brought Tony into the studio here. Hello, Tony.
Hello, Mr. Hilliker.
Great to have you.
Thank you.
So tell us just a bit about the city you're from.
Well, the city is called Dar es Salaam, and it's located along the coast of Tanzania. And it has about 4 million people. This is probably a census that was done in 2012. Probably more than that right now, but it's a city where you have a lot of people and the services usually tend to be a little bit less, just because you don't have a lot of service providers, such as like for different products, such as, you know, when you have water, electricity, and all that. But usually it's a hustle getting what you want.
And it's a hustle.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So we were at the food court there at the airport, and you were facing and looking kind of at the whole scene behind us, and you were just marveling and said something to the effect of, you know, this, it's amazing to see all of this. I guess there were probably about a dozen restaurants in a short, right, in a small space there. What was it about that struck you?
Well, first of all, it's just the organization of and how polite people are. And because I remember we were looking at the prices of the foods, and then there's a lady who was behind us, but in a way we weren't in the line. But what amazed me the most was after the fact that we knew what we wanted and we wanted to go back to the line, and this lady was like, no, you guys can go ahead. And
yeah,
that was just really nice and awesome to see. You don't see that in everyday life.
It is amazing how polite people tend to be in airports. That always strikes me whenever, right, I travel. But you're basically saying never in Tanzania.
It's a rare thing to happen. And whenever like you see somebody doing that, you know they're different. But yeah, here it's pretty much like everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, you do this, you find just people are so nice to you. It's just amazing and so relaxing and makes you feel a home in a way.
So you said that life is a hustle. Explain, yes, what you mean by that.
Okay, life is a hustle in a way, in different ways, in actual fact. Because, for example, what I was doing back there, I was working in this AC business where we will fix air conditioners and sell them and install them in houses. And that was really nice in a way. But if I was working for a company, let's say a company that was in Tanzania, it's really hard for them to pay you as much as you want to, because the minimum wage is so low. And that is, for example, I just knew this one watchman, you guys probably call them guards or something, and he
was a security guard.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, sir. He was really paid low. Like, let's say it was like $50 a month, and he had a family and he had to take care of all these things. So that actually was something that's pretty common in Tanzania, and that's why you have all these people starting to steal from their employers and all that. So
yeah,
pretty much
the salary they're getting isn't enough to feed the family, so they have to find other ways to,
exactly,
supplement their income. And
exactly,
you were describing some of the, say if you're working for an air conditioning company,
right,
and you're looking for other ways to supplement your income.
Exactly.
This is the hustle that you're talking,
right,
about. Explain,
right,
what you mean.
So this is, okay, so you get your salary and it's not enough. You have to find ways of making it up to get that amount that you need to survive. So what you need to do, probably, I mean, most of the people that do there, because they just start stealing. And how do they steal? For example, somebody can come to us and say, hey, I want to buy this. How much is it? And for me, I will be like, oh, this is a little bit higher than, you know, I won't tell this to the person who's buying the product. I'll just tell them like, oh, this is probably 50,000, while in actual fact it's 20,000. I mean, it's allowed, but in a way you're kind of like stealing to the person who's buying it, because that's not the actual price of what you're buying. And that's just one incident. But the other one is, let's say you're in a company and your boss probably says, oh, yeah, these things here, count them. Like these products, count them and then tell me how many they are. So in the counting process, people won't give the actual count. They'll give the less count in order to get the money for the other products that are not counted for.
So they'll take a couple and just sell them on their own?
Right.
And you were describing how, say, like at every level of interaction, if you're paying, you know, whoever it is that you're paying across the counter for a product, that person's boss and maybe that person's the provider,
right,
of that product, every link in that chain, people are trying to skim off just a,
right,
little bit extra, really, like you said, as a matter of survival.
Right, right. Yeah, that's really also common too. Like you see someone, let's say you want a certain service, let's say Let me just think of one quickly here. I mean, I can't have one that comes to mind quickly, but you will buy something and you will be surprised at the price of that product that you're buying. And you will start to think to yourself, like, why is it so high? But in actual fact, it's just you have all these people on top having extra, like adding the cost on that product. So the last person to buy that product is actually paying all these people who are above the person who's selling that, so that they can get at least a little bit from yeah. that product. But when you come to the government too, it's the same thing. It's similar to like the bribe thing. I mean, yeah. I don't know how it is right now because we have a new president, but that was a really big issue when I was down there two years ago.
Everything requires a bribe.
People will, like, every situation will make it easier for you to give a bribe. It's like, for example, if you get pulled over and the police is like, hey, you know what, you have this, and the cost for everything, the fine is like, let's say $50, but if you give me 20, I'm not going to record this.
Right.
So in a way, like, to you it makes sense, but right. It's not actually.
It's just a level of corruption, and right. you're encountering that at every level. It's right. If you apply for a passport and you say right. here's the amount of money for the passport, but the person who's taking your application says, well, if you give me a little bit extra, I'll right. make sure that actually gets through. If you don't pay that, essentially that passport application is going to get delayed indefinitely.
Right, right. It's really amazing how, like I was saying, the government and there's a difference. You can see the difference in the government system and the system that normal people, like private companies, use. Because the private companies actually do things really quickly because everyone there is paid nicely. If that company is like a foreign company, but if it's in there, usually not as good. But the private companies actually make things go really quickly just right. because they have people getting paid and people know that they have to keep their job in order to survive. But when it comes to the government, I mean, even you can go into the government bank, you have like 3 or 4 spots that are supposed to have people to take care of you. And you have this long queue waiting for people to come there, and only one person shows up. And that person just takes their time. They don't even
They're paid the same exactly. no matter how many people they service not.
So
they're in no hurry.
It's just a pain, and it's just hard to watch, like seeing all that happening. And then at the end of the day, somebody will be there probably the whole day, and right before, like when it reaches 5, they'll be like, okay, yeah, that's it for today. So that person has to come tomorrow early in the morning. And
yeah,
it's just
It seems like anyone who would question the value of free markets ought to take a visit to a country where they're not in use. Mm-hmm. And you were even talking about, say, if you had there is a certain amount of value in competition within the market. Right. If you have one cell phone company and then another company comes along and offers comparable services for less money, right. then suddenly the whole landscape changes. Talk right. about that a little bit.
Yeah. We used to have one big cell phone company, and it was really hard for other people to actually get the phone services and all that because the prices were so high and they couldn't afford it. And I can't remember the year exactly, but another company came and changed the whole scene. And this company just came and just said, you know what, we're going to give these people a free service. So they did that probably from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. I can't remember exactly the time, but this made other people to come and buy their services and actually start using their cellular network. And the other company had to drop the prices because of that. And they're just two. And then another company came And prices just went so low until probably everyone was able to afford a cell phone and they could actually use the services without any trouble. Right. So that was
more affordable price, better services.
Exactly.
Opening the market for a whole lot of people who wouldn't have been able to have it otherwise.
Right. Because we had all these companies, and now the one thought that came to mind was, oh, maybe it wasn't about the price. It was about the quality. Because once you have like four companies, I mean, cell phone companies, you will start asking yourself, okay, which one is good? Which one has better services?
Yeah.
So that's how the whole scenario like changed in Tanzania, and then things were just working so nicely up until now. I think there's still more coming in, but their cell phones are just so easy to buy and so easy to use. But on the other hand, you can see how that free market is important by just having, let's say we had one company that was in charge of the electricity, and that's the government company. And the services that they provide are really, really not good. I remember we had issues with our electricity, and they came and they were like, okay, this is really bad. We're going to disconnect you guys from electricity. I mean, from that electricity. And it took them for like about a week or so to come back and fix what they thought it was a problem. But not only they got late, but they also charged us for that.
Yeah.
So you can see people too telling you, like saying, hey, you know what? Why don't you just call these guys and tell them that you have this amount of money to offer? They're going to come quickly and everything is going to be solved. But my dad was like, we can't just
not willing
money.
To pay the bribe for something that should have been provided as a public service. Anyway.
Right. So that you can also see like how a free market will actually solve problems like those.
Yeah. I was reading a book about economics there was a whole section in there that was talking about bribery. Mm-hmm. And when I read that, I thought, you know, I've never paid a bribe in my life. Wow. And it just really struck me as that it was just something that I took for granted. And once I read just how common this is in countries all over the world, that this is a regular part of doing business. If you want to get anything done, you have to pay whoever it is that you're doing his little cut.
Right.
But the way that the economy works, this whole conversation just made me think how easy it is to take for granted those advantages that we enjoy in the United States of America. Mm-hmm. And a simple conversation with someone from Tanzania visiting a food court in an airport in an American city really helped to clarify that for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, a few other things that really struck me when I came to America. The first thing was how the services in the airports were and how the electricity stays on for a really long time. You don't have even to worry about, I got to iron my clothes so that, you know, when the electricity goes off, I'll be good to go, like for work and all that. And also the water service is constantly there. You don't need to think about, I need to have like buckets in order to fill the, or a tank somewhere to fill it with water. So whenever like it goes off, like it goes out, you have a reserve somewhere. Those were the things that when you grow up in Tanzania, they're constantly in your brain. You'll be doing laundry, but you also consider the fact that you need to iron those before, like the day before you go to work or school. And water too, if you don't have, like, if you're depending on the government, the water is not constant, just comes out for a few hours and then it goes away. So you have to have all these tanks, all these buckets. And also, like, flying across America, just looking down, you could actually see, like, how organized everything is. I didn't even land at the airport to see that, but just looking down and how the streets, how the roads are, how everything is just structured, was just mind blowing. I was like, wow, this is really a blessed country.
Yeah. Well, we sure appreciate your perspective. We've been talking with Herbert W. Armstrong College student Tony Seme about his home country of Tanzania. He's enjoyed, a year and a half or almost 2 years now in the United States, and he plans to be here for a couple more, at least to finish up his tenure here at HWAC. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, sir.
It's time for today's last word.
I suggest you get rid of something in your life. It's something most of us carry unwittingly. Even if we recognize it, we justify it. We think it's harmless, but it's not harmless. It's sin, and it wreaks terrible damage in our lives. Getting rid of it isn't easy, but doing so will make your life happier, simpler, and freer of stress. It will invite more of God's blessings, and it'll make you more like God. What am I talking about? I'm talking about your second set of measuring tools. Here is God's law. You can read this in Deuteronomy 25, verses 13 to 14. You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small. In ancient markets, transactions were placed on a scale and measured against standard weights. When a shady merchant would buy from suppliers, he might use a heavy weight to make it appear he was receiving less than he actually was. When he then turned around to sell, he could get out his lighter weights in order to give less than his customer had paid for. You're not an open market vendor, but it is easier to have two different scales of measurement than you may think. You wouldn't steal a television from a retail store, but you might steal time from your employer by slacking off when nobody is looking. You wouldn't rob a bank, but you might not justify reporting certain income on your taxes. You wouldn't have an affair, but you might look at a salacious website. You may not lie about that frivolous purchase at the mall, but you might hide the fact that you cheated on your diet in a moment of weakness. Still, you consider yourself a person of integrity. You do the right thing in the big areas where it really matters. But then you give yourself a pass for fudging occasionally in little areas where the policy doesn't apply to you or it's too small to matter. This won't hurt anyone. No one will know. That's two different measures. Is stealing wrong? Then why would a little bit be okay? Is hatred wrong? Then what makes it acceptable to simply keep it to yourself and pretend you have nothing but love? Why try to justify virtual lust when God says that harboring it in the heart is adultery and it'll burn you just as surely as holding fire near your chest? God says in Luke 16, verse 10, that if you're faithful in that which is least, he can entrust you with greater things. But if you're dishonest in the small areas, your integrity is compromised. God is looking at your character. Your conduct in the little matters tells him all he needs to know about the person you really are. You might have two different scales, one to judge your friends and allies and another to judge your enemies, or one to weigh your own actions and another to weigh other people's. You might use one measure for when you're alone and another for when others are watching. A merchant using falsified measures is being deliberately dishonest. The double standards we tend to hold are subtler, but they're just as dishonest. Every day, many opportunities arise to exercise such deceit, even in very small areas. Track yourself through the day and see if you hold a double standard in certain details, giving yourself permission to think or do things you wouldn't want other people to know about. The basic reason we possess two measures in these subtler forms is that our human nature likes to think of itself as good. We can be astonishingly adept at justifying dishonesty. But if you find two measures, honestly assess why you have them. God wants us to be totally honest. His law says, you shall have a perfect and just weight, a perfect and just measure. God knows diverse weights and measures when he sees them, and he calls breaking this law an abomination. In 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 8, the Apostle Paul summarized God's way of life with two words, sincerity and truth. Sincerity means purity. The Greek literally means found pure when unfolded and examined by the sun's light. That's what God wants for your life, for you to be able to live in a way that your innermost heart can be unfolded in broad sunlight, scrutinized, and found pure. Truth means that which is true and free from error, but it also means truth as a personal virtue, a mind free from pretense, falsehood, deceit. So it's closely linked with the concept of sincerity. The gap between two measures is a form of hypocrisy, proclaiming one standard and living by another. The reality is that it's virtually impossible not to have some hypocrisy if you're trying to uphold godly standards. We all fall short of the ideals we profess. The question is how wholeheartedly we're working to close the gap between profession and action. We shouldn't rest content with any lack of integrity or personal deception or dissonance between what we know to be right and what we do. Our aim must be perfect harmony between the two, living each moment like God is right there watching and measuring. Don't weigh your own goodness by other people's opinions. Don't calculate your righteousness by comparing it with sinners worse than yourself. Don't evaluate your thoughts by a lighter standard than your deeds. Get rid of all your weights and measures and keep the one and only perfect and just measure, God's. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Noctegal, Andrew Miller, and Tony Semme. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Pat Conroy. Once you have traveled, the voyage never ends, but is played out over and over again in the quietest chambers that the mind can never break off from the journey. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.